And you're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 100.5 FM.
Bamboo shoots were used as rudimentary pipelines to transport natural gas in ancient China. Fast forward 2,500 years, and not only have we improved on pipeline technology, we've also discovered that if you liquefy, then compress natural gas, it becomes much easier to transport to places where pipelines don't exist. Christy Clark's government has promised that building an LNG industry in BC to service the energy needs of Asia will be the economic savior of this province. Ben Parfit is a resource policy analyst for the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, and he doesn't agree. He spoke at SFU Harbour Centre earlier this month at an event organized by the Council of Canadians. He began his talk with a slideshow, but describes each slide in detail so those not in attendance can follow along.
So I was thinking on the way over on the ferry how much things change in the space of a few months, and certainly in the space of a few years, in the resource industries that have typically driven much of the economy of our province. So the pictures that I'm going to start off showing you tonight came from a field trip that I did with a couple of gentlemen, one of whom's in the room this evening, Will Coop, and photographer by the name of Garth Lenz, whose work you may be familiar with. Garth has done a huge amount of work documenting the developments in the tar sands, Alberta's tar sands, and the effects downstream on the great river systems of the north of Alberta. So I want to give people a sense for what was going on the ground a few years ago, when the natural gas industry was actually really booming. If you fast forward to today, there is nowhere near the drilling activity that was happening a few years ago. And that, of course, has everything to do with the fact that commodity prices have a way of swinging wildly in one direction or another. And right now, we're mired in North America with relatively close to historically low gas prices, and it's had a huge dampening effect on the industry. But back in 2010, when I was in this area near Hudson's Hope, there was a level of development going on at that time that I had never before seen, and it really was indicative of what was going to happen as the unconventional gas resources of Northeast BC in these shale zones and sandstone formations started to get developed. So I wanted to give people just a quick sense of what was going on at the time, and I'm going to make a few observations about how things have changed in the interim. So this is a man named Bob Webster. This is a piece of property that he and his wife, Terry, cleared over many arduous weeks and months after they finished their day jobs to create this open area where they now raise buffalo. And if you look at the landscape behind Bob in the distance, and if you were to go over that height of land, you would be looking at the Williston Reservoir, which of course is the largest body of water in British Columbia, created by the damming of the Peace River at the W.A.C. Bennett Dam, which is not too far away from where this picture was taken. And the Williston Reservoir, of course, is the source of pretty much a quarter of all the lights in the Lower Mainland here, and the lights in this room. It is the major hydroelectric source in our current hydro system. There is a second dam, of course, below the W.A.C. Bennett Dam, the Peace Canyon Dam. And as all of us know, there is a proposal to put a third dam on the Peace River system, which would create a new 80-kilometer-long reservoir that would pretty much reach the community of Fort St. John. So this is an area of the province that has been the driver, if you will, of much of the economic activity that has occurred in the province over the last half century. And now this region is potentially to be the site of some of the most intensive gas extraction efforts anywhere in North America. It will rival what's happened in Texas and what started to revolutionize the shale gas industry in North America a little over a decade ago. So at the time that Will, Garth, and I were doing our field work in this area, we got a good sense of the rush at that time that was on for water in this neck of the woods. And there were signs similar to this one here that let the viewer know that companies had rights of access to water to use in their hydraulic fracturing or fracking operations. This here is a sign letting the viewer know that Talisman Energy, the major company that was operating in the area at the time and that is still the major operator in this particular area, had rights to withdraw water from this water body through permits that had been given to it by the Provincial Oil and Gas Commission. And I'm going to talk a bit more about the OGC a little bit later on, and I'm sure Damien will have a few things to say about the OGC as well. But this gives you an idea about the signage that was out there, and that's just one small section of the Williston Reservoir in the background. Now, at the time, the company was withdrawing almost all of its water by using pumps that were out in these water bodies and pumping the water into the holds of these trucks, which were operating 24 hours a day. When the three of us arrived in Hudson's Hope about 10 or 10:30 at night, the first night, there were three or four of these trucks parked at a turnoff on the Peace River just outside of town, loading in the dead of night. So these trucks were working all the time to move water in position for fracking operations that were taking place or were soon to take place in this area, which is known as the Farrell Creek operations of Talisman. Again, this gives you some idea of the priority that the company was giving to safeguarding its water interests and gives you a bit of a flavor for the energy intensity that is required to move water by bulk in tanker trucks. This gives you, again, an idea about the energy required. Imagine moving all of that water up that steep incline, in this case, water that was being pulled from the Peace River down in the background there. Now, this gives you a bit of a sense of the land impact of these operations. What you're looking at here is the equivalent of about an 8-lane highway in width. All of the forest that has been cleared here is forest that is permanently removed from our forest land base. It's taken right out and right down to, through the organic soil layer. And all of those piles of wood that you can see and that stretch off into the distance, all of them will be burned. So this is what is required to set the stage for the fracking that happens. The reason for the width of this road is that you're going to be running a lot of water and ultimately gas feeder lines through this landscape to connect with bigger gas lines that will move the gas further afield. This gives you a bit of a sense of the further impacts to the land base and starts to give you a bit of a flavor for what is happening with all this water. So there were pits like this situated every few hundred meters. This pit here, when filled, would probably hold the equivalent of somewhere between 5 and 10 Olympic swimming pools worth of water. And there was pit after pit after pit staged with water in it, ready to be diverted to the well sites for fracking operations. This again gives you a little bit more of a perspective. You see the water, you see a truck in the background, you see pipes leading up to the road that would divert the water that had been either taken from the Williston Reservoir or the Peace River or any one of a number of other rivers and creeks and brought into this site. And then here you have a gas well pad that is under development. You see the flare stacks there indicating gas that is being flared off and all of course, the associated greenhouse gas emissions. But the water that pits that I showed you earlier, the water would be being diverted from one pit to another to get it to close to the fracking operation for use in the fracking process. This gives you a bit of an understanding about the size of these well pads. Typically, what is happening in Northeast British Columbia today is that several wells are being drilled on one very large pad. So typically what's happening on many well pads today in the northeast of the province is you've got 10 to 12 wells that might be getting drilled on one pad. All of the wells get drilled down to the desired shale or sandstone formation, which may be down a couple of kilometers below the earth's surface. And then the drilling direction is oriented out horizontally for well over a kilometer, and now well over 2 kilometers. And then all of the water that has been gathered is pressure pumped underground at immense pressure, enough to trigger small earthquakes to break up or fracture the rock, hence the term hydraulic fracturing, which has been shortened to fracking. Typically, you're looking at immense amounts of water, chemicals introduced into the water that provide for a number of important services, chemicals that help to reduce the friction of the water that is being pumped underground, that prevent bacteriological growth that might impede gas flow, that kind of thing. And also immense amounts of very fine-grained sand, which is pressure pumped into the rock that has been fractured to hold open the fractures so that the gas can continue to be released. And this gives you a bit of an understanding of the, or appreciation for the huge energy resources that are required. You need to have immense numbers of trucks that are coming in with huge diesel compressors on them that allow for the water to be pressure pumped underground. And the Oil and Gas Commission, among many that have looked at this pressure pumping, have concluded that there is incontestable evidence that small earthquakes are being triggered as a result of this activity, and there is a correlation without question between the amount of water that is pressure pumped and the frequency and number of those earthquakes. So a study that was done by the Oil and Gas Commission a couple of years ago correlated these incidents of earthquakes with water use at individual fracking operations. This gives you a flavor for some of the wastewater that flows back. So I mentioned chemicals earlier, but keep in mind that whatever that water comes into contact with underground is going to come back with all the water that flows back. So any heavy metals, any radiological compounds, all of those things will flow back with that water. You can take water that is pure, fresh water, pump it underground, and what you'll get back is something that might be 5 times saltier than ocean water, and it will be contaminated with whatever chemicals are introduced along in the fracking process. I'm not going to speak much about this slide because I know Damien's going to talk about it. Damien and Will have been doing some investigation into this, but I just want to give you a sense of the scale of the waste water pits that have to be put in place to deal with all of that toxic wastewater. Now, Talisman typically has been recapturing the waste water that has flowed back up when these wells are fracked, and they have reused that water in subsequent fracking operations, which is an industry innovation that is on the plus side of things. However, at some point in time, what ends up happening is the water becomes so contaminated that it cannot even be used in the fracking process, at which point it has to be pressure pumped deep underground for permanent disposal. There are no industrial scale wastewater treatment plants to deal with this toxic wastewater. And I can tell you that in instances where toxic wastewater has been diverted for treatment to municipal water treatment facilities, as was the case in Pennsylvania, the water was so toxic that it actually damaged the water treatment equipment and they had to stop delivering water to those treatment plants. So this is highly toxic water. It begins fresh in many cases. It is permanently removed from the hydrological cycle because it is so contaminated. It cannot be reintroduced to rivers, lakes, and streams without causing significant environmental damage. And the only way we have to deal with it right now in terms of treating it is to pressure pump it out of deep underground, out of sight, out of mind. Now, I want to pause for a minute just to recap a couple of things here. What I've just shown you is literally a drop in the bucket of what could happen in British Columbia. For one thing, what I'm showing you here is water consumption in the what's called the Montney Formation, which is the southernmost of the two big shale gas formations that are currently under development in BC. The Montney uses about one-tenth of the water that is used in a typical fracking operation in the Horn River Basin. So in the Horn River Basin, massive amounts of water, more than what I've just shown you, have to come into play in order to produce the gas, because geological formations vary in terms of character, and the formation in the Horn River Basin has a hell of a lot of gas, but it requires a heck of a lot more water to get that gas flowing than is the case in the Montney. So this is a shot of a lake body called Two Island Lake. It's where a world record was set for fracking in the late months of 2010, 2011. So a picture of a well pad with, I think, 10 wells on it, or 12 wells, Will, do you recall, for 63K? Or was it 14?
14 or 16.
Yeah. Somewhere between 14 and 16 wells on a well pad near this lake, all fracked over the course of 121 days with 600 Olympic swimming pools worth of water, toxified forever. That's what was required at what was then a world record frack job, and it no doubt has been exceeded since, because what happens as the industry gets more efficient in its fracking is that they extend the reaches of these horizontal well bores, meaning you have to have more water used to get the gas out of the ground. Now, Damien's going to be talking a lot more about the environmental impacts, but I do want to focus a bit on water, because that's something that I have been looking at a lot in the last year, and it is critical to the future of gas development in the province if the gas development that the Premier and the Energy Minister advocate is going to happen. If what they advocate for transpires, you are going to see a rush on our water resources unlike anything that has ever been seen, certainly in the northeast of the province. It's going to be unprecedented in scale. To get 4 LNG plants built on our coast, which is a stated objective of the provincial government, by 2020, we will have to quadruple or quintuple record-setting gas production in 2012 in order to get that much gas to 4 LNG facilities. It is a massive increase in the amount of gas drilling, fracking, and water consumption that will have to occur. So I started to talk about these 4 LNG facilities. So let's assume that the government's goal is realized and we have 4 world-scale LNG facilities up and running, 2 in Prince Rupert and 2 in Kitimat. We have to quadruple or possibly quintuple our current gas production. And a conservative estimate that I'm working on with a former senior official with Natural Resources Canada is that we're going to have to drill somewhere around 38,000 wells between now and 2040 to channel enough gas to those 4 LNG facilities. One has to assume that if a company is going to invest $10 billion or so in one of these plants, that they certainly intend to run it for a period of time. So I'm assuming a 20-year period, which translates into trillions of liters of water that are going to have to be required to be found and used in the fracking process. So, big question, who's going to manage this water rush? Well, the answer to that question is that the Oil and Gas Commission is going to be managing that water rush on our behalf. That's what's going to happen. So historically in this province, if you go back prior to the creation of the Oil and Gas Commission, which was set up under an NDP government in the late 1990s as a quote-unquote one-stop shop for regulatory approvals for the energy sector, prior to that happening, the Ministry of Environment provincially was in charge of all water assignments to anyone So whether you were a major water consumer like a pulp and paper sector or a company, or whether you were a municipality, or whether you were an irrigation district, or whether you were a commercial enterprise, you all had to go to the Ministry of Environment to get approval to withdraw water. And there were only two ways that you could get access to water. You either got it through the issuance of a temporary permit, which allowed for a one-time withdrawal limited to a year, or you got water licenses. With the creation of the Oil and Gas Commission, the Oil and Gas Commission assumed responsibility for issuing Section 8 permits, these temporary permits to the oil and gas sector. And with a cabinet directive that was passed with little fanfare in, I believe, April of this year, the Oil and Gas Commission was given the last powers that had been withheld from it as far as water assignments were concerned, and it was given the responsibility to issue long-term water licenses to these companies. So we have a dedicated energy sector regulator that is now tasked with approving wells, approving pipelines, approving roads, approving logging, approving just about anything that is needed to get the ball rolling, and is now in charge of approving water assignments, and is also supposed to be there to ensure the highest environmental and human health and safety standards are met. It's a totally unique beast in the province. Nobody else can get rights of access to water from anyone other than what is now the Ministry of Forest, Lands and Natural Resource Operations, which took over the historic powers from the Ministry of Environment. The only industry in the province that has its own dedicated regulator assigning it rights of water is the oil and gas industry. It's the only exception to the rule in the province. Now, some of you may know that there are key reforms that are being proposed under a new Water Sustainability Act. There are some good things that are potentially coming into play. The devil's going to be in the details as to how good and how effective that act is, but we can anticipate that there's going to be groundwater regulation in the province. We can anticipate that there is going to be some heightened monitoring of who's using what, which is certainly long overdue. But as I say, the devil's going to be in the details. A public comment period just ended last Friday, and we will see new legislation sometime, we're told, next year. But there's some big questions hanging out there. How will water use be tracked? By who? Will it be held by a central repository? Will everybody be required to submit their information on what they take? Will that information be published on a watershed-by-watershed basis so we know precisely what the impacts of these large-scale withdrawals are on catchment areas? All of that is up in the air right now. And very importantly, who is going to decide when enough is enough? We're told that there's going to be opportunities for new governance structures under this proposed new act, but again, the devil's in the details. What powers, for example, are local First Nations going to have in terms of being able to say yay or nay to proposed developments along the lines of what I've shown you? So I want to turn now to just a few of the sort of economic questions that are swirling out there that I think we need to get our minds wrapped around. BC and LNG's economic promise. So what we're told by the provincial government, or certainly we're told prior to the provincial election campaign, is that if we can get pipelines, big gas pipelines built to the coast, and if we can get a network of liquefied natural gas terminals built, that the door will be open to retiring our provincial debt, our accumulated provincial debt, and growing a prosperity fund, a so-called prosperity fund, to the tune of about $100 billion over a very short period of time. That's what the Premier and Energy Minister have promised us. To do this, we need to build new pipelines to the coast, one major line at least to Kitimat, and one major line at least to Prince Rupert, and there's also proposals to even put LNG facility in Howe Sound. Why is this being proposed? The major reason for it is that BC's natural gas assets are, as some call it, landlocked. There's nowhere for our gas to go except in North America. And the prices in North America for gas are extremely depressed because there's a glut of gas on the market right now. So the whole idea is that we need to get our one-time fossil fuel wealth to the coast as quickly as possible. We need to supercool it in these LNG facilities, and we need to get it into the holds of tanker ships, and we need to get those tanker ships over to China, Korea, Japan, and elsewhere, where there's currently a price premium being paid for that gas. So that's what the promise is. Now, I tend to think, having looked at the wildly swinging fortunes of the forest sector, that we might want to think through whether this LNG plan doesn't pose some problems. So we've all heard about the commodity trap. Commodity prices have a way of swinging very wildly. If you put too much of something on the market price usually falls to the detriment of the people that are trying to move those commodities around. So a classic example of how when this happened in British Columbia is, if you go back a decade, the mountain pine beetle was in full outbreak mode in the interior of the province. The provincial government said to the forest companies, hey, we're going to allow you to log 50 to 60% more, 100% more than what you were logging just yesterday in order to salvage economic value from this resource, right? And the upshot was, we saw logging rates ramp up to levels that were clearly unsustainable. We saw companies investing hundreds of millions of dollars in sawmills that became the largest of their kind in the world. And we started to flood the North American market, particularly the U.S. housing market, with lumber. And guess what happened? The prices fell. And then, to add insult to injury, the subprime mortgage crisis came along and everything plummeted. But here we are a decade later. The resource that was supposed to bring all this wealth to British Columbia failed to deliver. We're now on the afterside of that with a vastly depleted resource. We've got sawmills now that are closing. We've got communities that are facing all kinds of hardship as a result of this. And bear in mind, this is through the mismanagement of a renewable resource, not a one-time-only, non-renewable fossil fuel resource. So we need to think through these things, because the upshot is likely to be, on the afterside of the pine beetle outbreak, that a handful of companies are going to end up monopolizing control of our public forest resources. That's likely to be the outcome. The stage is already being set for that. I'm not making up the word foot race here. This is what Energy Minister Rich Coleman said that British Columbia was in terms of getting its natural gas onto export markets. We're in a foot race with other suppliers around the world who also have gas resources of their own that they want to cash in on. So the classic example of this is Australia, which is way ahead of us in the foot race. They currently have 7 LNG facilities under construction down under. Every one of them is vastly over budget, between 15 and 40%. If you take 15% of the value on one LNG facility that was proposed and recently canceled, you'd add about $7 billion to the construction cost. It was a $45 billion project that got shelved. These are very, very big dollars that are coming into play, and I think it's instructive that the National Energy Board in British Columbia approved the first export of gas in British Columbia over 2 years ago now, and the proponents of that particular project have yet to commit the funds to build the LNG plant. And I think that there's a reason for that. People are very nervous about spending $10 billion or more on these projects, not knowing whether they're going to get a good return. So we've seen cancellation of high-cost projects in Australia. And there's also a growing fear, and you can see it in the business press in Australia, that Australia alone may be capable of oversupplying the Asian market, with the end result that prices fall, royalties fall, taxes fall, and the state is left with potentially a huge economic white elephants, tremendous environmental costs, and suddenly something that was supposed to be a revenue generator is turning into a huge liability. Other things to keep in mind. China may have shale gas resources to equal those of the United States. Russia is very close to China, has huge natural gas resources of its own that it is actively exploiting and trying to figure out how to move more of into the hands of China and other Asian buyers. And Japan, which is often talked about as a recipient of our gas, is not standing still. So we need to remember that Japan not too long ago went through a huge disaster in the wake of the tsunami and the problems at the Fukushima nuclear plant. There's not a lot of appetite in Japan right now for more nuclear power. So there's likely to be increases in the consumption of natural gas and coal to fire Japan's industry and economy. But bear this in mind. Japan is at the forefront of a global effort to exploit something called methane hydrate. Methane hydrate is gas on the seabed that is trapped in lattices of an ice-like structure. It's literally ice that you can light on fire. That's what it looks like, and that's how it's characterized. The global methane hydrate resource is estimated by the U.S. Geological Survey to be 2 times greater than all of our coal, conventional natural gas, and oil resources on Earth combined. 2 times more. Now, there's a reason why it hasn't been exploited to date, because it's very exotic stuff. And why exploit that when it's easier to get at conventional supplies? But Japan, this year in March, just successfully extracted the first large-scale amount of methane hydrate from the seafloor near Australia. And in the next day's business pages in Australia, people were saying, this could be a real problem. Because if Japan figures out how to commercialize methane hydrate, and it could easily do that in the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to be a world potentially awash in natural gas. And it's really going to cast into doubt the economic viability of LNG plants here if they get built and elsewhere in the world. So this is a quote, a paraphrase quote from the business press in Australia. For leading LNG producers like Australia, the fear is, quote, severe disruption, end of quote, of global LNG markets, casting doubt on the financial viability, quote, of LNG projects in Australia, Malaysia, and Papua New Guinea. Now add to the end of the equation that if LNG facilities get built here in Canada, Australia actually has an advantage in servicing some of the markets that we would be putting gas into because it's closer. So it's this thing that I'm talking about, if Japan is successful, and there's many people that believe that they will be, all bets are off in terms of the revenues that are likely going to be generated from LNG facilities here. All of this economic projection, such as it is, that has been made by the BC government, is predicated on a high price continuing to be paid in Asia for gas. Currently, Asian buyers are consumers are paying about 5 times the price that is paid here in Canada and in the United States. But the big question is that price differential going to be carried forward 4 or 5 or 6 years from now? Because that's how long it's going to take before we see any LNG production in British Columbia, assuming that a corporate shareholders group gives the green light to one of these operations going ahead. Forecasting what commodity prices are going to be is extremely difficult on a quarterly basis. Trying to suggest what the commodity prices are going to be 5 years from now is virtually impossible. So the question has to be asked, how does the provincial government arrive at a calculation that our entire provincial debt is wiped out and that we put $100 billion into a future prosperity fund? We have to ask what the assumptions are around those numbers that the government is using. This is a quote from a research institute in Seattle talking about LNG. Characterizing it as the highest risk piece of the global energy business, quote, markets change and you can end up doing things and spending money on things that 5 years later look very dumb. Chasing higher future gas prices. I wouldn't count on it. There's more than one way to get our LNG or our natural gas to markets. Japan, as we speak, is already saying that it's not interested in continuing to pay the higher prices that it's paying. It is striking deals as we speak with LNG producers in the Gulf of Mexico, and it is subsidizing Japanese companies that are able to make deals with U.S. producers to get gas out of the Gulf Coast. There is no reason to believe that gas from the north of British Columbia could not end up getting diverted through existing pipeline infrastructure to the Gulf and from the Gulf out to Asian markets. There would be a financial penalty in that it would take a couple of days longer to get the product to the Asian market. But that would have to be weighed against the savings of billions of dollars in pipeline investments and new LNG facilities. So if you take a look at the arc of the narrative on this story, pre-election, Christy Clark was talking all about how we were going to have a super profits tax and we were going to get filthy rich off of LNG. Post-election, she's quoted in the Wall Street Journal saying that it is her number one priority to make BC, quote, the most cost-competitive jurisdiction on earth for LNG. Translation, lower taxes, lower royalty rates, more subsidies, more infrastructure credits. Whatever we need to do to get shovels in the ground is what we're going to do here in British Columbia to get this industry going. Missing in action is any credible numbers on the provincial government's part that shows what those subsidies are going to look like, but it's time that we started asking our elected MLAs in our ridings for those numbers, because I don't believe the government has them. So earlier this year, I posited that, you know, perhaps the time had been had come to ask whether we have a backup plan. Because what happens if the first plan doesn't work? I think that there's good reason to believe it won't work, at least not to the degree that the government is talking about. I personally think that we would be lucky, well, or unlucky, depending on how you want to look at it, to see two LNG facilities on our coast, not six, seven, or eight. So we keep hearing these numbers about new companies coming in with new LNG proposals. I just don't see how you end up with a handful of these operations on our coast. So if that plan doesn't materialize, the question needs to be asked, do we have a plan B? And I think some of the cornerstones that we could look at for an alternate vision about how we use this resource is, instead of rushing every last drop of it to the coast, we start to parcel it out and treat it like the finite resource that it is and started to use it more appropriately. We should be staging down the amount of gas that we're using and drilling for in British Columbia, not ramping it up like some Wild West scenario. I think we could make the argument that you could use natural gas more strategically in some cases to displace domestic diesel fuel burning. I think you could make the argument that in some cases gas could be used in greater abundance to act as a bridge for renewables. We could be looking at using gas as a power source rather than flooding 6,000 hectares of land and taking it out of the agriculture land reserve. And when you talk to people in the northeast of the province that are living with the consequences of hydro, of massive wind power projects on their doorstep and gas, they're going like, please tell me why we're going to build another dam on the Peace River region so that we can export all of our gas out of the province. Why wouldn't we use some of that gas here and avoid having to have that huge ecological footprint of the Site C dam? So those are questions that are being asked by residents that live up there. I think lastly, we want to be ending all subsidies to the gas sector. We should not be subsidizing an industry that is has the potential to become the single largest greenhouse gas emission source in our province. We should be requiring full pre-development planning with First Nations and making cumulative impacts on their lands and territories a top priority. We should be completely eliminating all gas flaring, and we should be making British Columbia the jurisdiction, leading jurisdiction in the on Earth in terms of controlling methane leaks from gas infrastructure. And we should be requiring full carbon capture and storage from any facilities that we do put in place in BC. So lastly, before turning it over to Damien, and thank you very much for having patience and letting me go through a lot of material here, I would encourage you to really become part of the conversation. This is going to be a huge, huge issue over the next few years. Follow us and what we're doing at the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. I'd really encourage you to do that. And I will end by saying that I've had the pleasure of speaking with Damien on other panels. I'm really looking forward to what he has to say. Damien is working tirelessly on this issue and helping to bring out a lot of great things to light.
Can you just tell me, are there any operating LNG plants in Australia or anywhere?
Yes, there are several operating. I don't know what the exact number is in Australia right now, but several in operation, seven under construction, and some that, at least one major project in the last half year that has been shelved out of a concern. I think
the Chevron one, it was $52
billion. Yeah, that's the one. I think it's the cost was $48 billion, but anyways, it's off the charts.
That project has come here to run the Shell project here, so you can give us an idea of the kind of expertise at work here.
Yeah, a good point. I should just very quickly add one other thing. Job numbers. Bear in mind that if Shell gets going with its proposed plant in Kitimat, it's entirely conceivable that the whole thing is built modularly in Asia, and shipped over in modules here, okay? And lastly, again, the pictures that I showed you of Talisman Energy, Talisman Energy is likely to be out of the picture now. It had a proposal to take gas from that area that I showed you and ship it to Edmonton. The proposal was to work with Sasol, a South African company, to turn gas into liquid fuels, which is different from LNG. But that plan has wavered. It's foundered, and the company is now in the throes of being taken over by Petronas, which is the big proponent in the Prince Rupert area for putting in a big LNG plant. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
I look forward to the discussion.
That was Ben Parfit speaking earlier this month at an event organized by the Council of Canadians. Ben Parfit is a resource policy analyst for the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. For more information, you can visit their website at policyalternatives.ca.